In the middle of the 19th century, a new means of communication burst upon the world to set in motion a train of events of consequences that even now cannot be reckoned. This is the telegraph. It is a matter of great significance and meaning, at least to us. It's the first word that over the first wire between Washington and Baltimore would be. And they apparently characterize the inventor. The words were "Up at Bob Ross." So today, over a retrospect of 30 years, we are watching the building of a new means of communication, characterized not by material, but a new way of speaking the language of heart, one to another. And this language is a varied language, and we have participated in one of its magnificent variations in this meeting, having in it these components of science and of the spirit, the only synthesis of any great promise to the world of our time, who have been part of this. I wish to renew thanks and glory to myself. Indeed, may I speak for all of you. And thanks to each of you and to God for these precious hours now drawing to close. I would like to direct our special gratitude to Don and to Luke and to their co-workers whose selfless efforts have made this occasion possible. I think to a woman and to a man, we are remembering that Don made his demonstration in the face of adversity, the adversity of precarious health, a source of information or inspiration that will be with us always. College talk. Recall other days. Spirit of dedication and of love that characterized that couple will live in this society, within this society forever, and its waves will lap on ever more distant shores. As we heard this last magnificent talk, I began to think of the embryo that was the beginning of AA, that preceded the birth into the new life. And each of us in this far-flung society. We're in that embryo, but it was a very unpromising moon. Far until recent times, the only result could have been stillbirth into deformity, lunacy, or stillborn into the grave. And in that we were. And for most of us, it was a very dark place, only illumined by the few who chose to stay with us until the end should come. Lois was my companion. And we searched for years to find the entrance through which we might merge into better things. And we had not found the grave to make that discovery. And then it seems to us, or it seems to us now, that Providence was preparing a table, the one at which we have since so joyously feasted. And one by one, those who were to participate in the creation of this benign synthesis began to place candles on that table. And though we knew it not, this was the beginning of a new means of communication, each with the other. The language of the heart as spoken in AA. In a sense, I suppose our beginnings are infinite ages old, because there has never been any age in which the impulse to reach for a higher power was absent since man became conscious. Then came Carpenter. And of course, we are in his position and teaching. But I would like to pinpoint in terms of people who the personal candle bearers were in the beginning. And I am happy to say, especially so, since we have heard so much good-natured, and perhaps not so good-natured, derogation of society, that this man happened to be a psychiatrist. And in view of many of mine, one of the great figures of our generation. I speak of Carl Jung. One of the three founders of the modern art of depth psychology. He was distinguished from the other founders in that he felt, and I am sure knew in his inner heart, that man was something more than a modicum of intelligence often ill used. He was something more than a bundle of instincts. Something more than $2 worth of chemicals. I'm sure of this because I know people who have been in contact with him. And one of my chief regrets is that a correspondence that we had begun before his death had not been started years earlier. So vision, if you will, a prominent American businessman who I should call Roland. Roland was the typical case. He had exhausted every resource he knew. So he came to Carl Jung. And they spent a year together. And Roland became convinced that now so many of the hidden springs of his strange compulsions and motivations would reveal that he would drink no more. Leaving the doctor, he was drunk within a month. To him, this was a ghastly experience. This was the end. And he came back to Dr. Carl and said, Carl, you were my court of last resort. Is there anything else? And this very kind old gentleman said, Roland, I thought that you might have been one of those rare cases in which my art might help you to sobriety and better things. But now I know your case is that of such gravity and complication that my art will not unravel it. And the patient took another dive for deflation at depth, the basis on which our whole recovery rests. He hit bottom. But he persisted. Doctor, is there no other recourse for me? And the dear old gentleman said, Roland, yes, there may be, but I must be frank with you. It doesn't happen often. I speak to you of a conversion experience. Oh, but I, said Roland, I used to be a vestryman in the church. My faith has still not left me. But this hasn't worked. Jung said, I am talking about something that goes beyond faith. I am talking about a transforming experience in which the recipient, as a gift, appears to undergo a motivation change that cannot be accounted for by simple faith, by environment, by motivation, by association. These profound changes seem to transcend the sum of all of the ordinary resources that can be bought. Now he said among alcoholics, as among other men of all time, these profoundly transforming experiences have occurred here and there. He cannot tell to whom or when the lightning of providence will flash. So I suggest that you immerse yourself in a religious atmosphere, remembering your personal helplessness, and pray for God's will. So that is a word picture of the colloquy that took place between these two men about 1932. And this great and humble man had placed the first candle, which was to illumine the table at which we supped. Roland associated himself with the Oxford group then in Europe, and practiced their principles, none of which was new. They had an emphasis. There was the idea of one person talking to the next. You know the rest of it. Our basics were abstracted from it. And unaccountably, Roland seemed to be released. He hadn't been educated out of drinking. He had been released from it. Then he came to America, where he fell under the spell of Dr. Sam Shoemaker, one of the founders of the Oxford group that old time. And Sam was then also rector at an Episcopal church stood at 23rd Street in New York. And in the Oxford group, there were a handful of them who had been released. Most of them, rather temporarily, but genuine release, nonetheless, by this sort of practice and attitude. And Roland bethought himself of an old school friend. This school friend is the one so affectionately known to us as Ebbie. I'll pause here, having illustrated to you this theme of influence, beginning with Jung, to the O.J. Hazard. Let's come down on the other tack and see what happened at the confluence. I've gone the route. The story's old to you. You've read it. I've told you 1,000 times the story of my drinking. So I shall quickly bring myself to that day in 1934, midsummer, when another physician by speaking. Dear old Dr. Silkwood, who certainly will be known in our annals as a medical saint for so long as they shall last. Someone once wrote a grapevine piece about him, and the title was this: The Little Doctor Who Loved Trump. And from the point of view of the rationalist and the scientific man, the little doctor was a nobody. Even crime was an odd idea. He said that, sure, there is a lunatic compulsion to drink. Certainly, true enough. No doubt it may have psychological causes, trauma, youth, etc. But he said, I think that there is a big moral question. And he also said, I believe that there is something wrong with the body, metabolism of alcoholics. For short, not knowing what it is, I use a widely understood term called allergy. So this adds up to a compulsion that condemns the victim to drink against his will and interest until the destruction is complete. And this is joined to a physical condition that ensures his lunacy and finally his demise. On this hot summer night, this dear little man grew up to then, had worked in drying out joints, Finally Towns Hospital, where I used to go, with perhaps 25,000 drunks, occasional successes here and there. He worked on a pittance. He boarded in the place. He had a room up there. So, as gently as he could, told us what the score was. Just like you, speaking to Roland, he said, when Bill came here, he clearly wanted so desperately to come. That thought he might be one of you. But I'm afraid that I must say that he isn't. He's beginning to be deteriorated. I'm afraid if he would remain sane or even live long, he will have to be committed. So this is Ben. There's science and the person to Dr. Jung and of Dr. Silkworth asked upon me, upon all of us, and both these truly great men, great human beings, had had the courage to say what they believed. Well, meanwhile, my friend Abby had got into such state that he was about to be committed for lunacy at a state institution in Vermont where the family is from. Town fathers had wearied of Abby. His last exploit had consisted of his just borrowing the old man's brand new Cadillac, running it down a main street a little ways off in the country at a very high speed, and quite without thinking, he veered off the road, across a narrow field, and into the side of a farmhouse. And this was the kitchen L, or end of the house. It was not built very strongly. So the car went right into the kitchen with Abby still sitting there. And this kind of jolted him away. A towering woman sat in the corner. And of course, Abby saw, even through his haze, that it was an awkward moment. And he leaned out and he said, "Well," he says, "what about a cup of coffee?" For the town fathers, this was it. So they gathered up Ebbe, hailed him before the judge down at Bennington, and just as he was about to be routed to the Hoosgow at Brattleboro, then appeared Hazard, along with a couple of other drunks from the Oxford group. And they took Ebbe into tow, and they got him sort of indoctrinated on the desirability of honesty, restitution, helping other people, prayer, and so forth. They brought him down to New York. Well, just after leaving the hospital, I had stayed sober for months out of sheer fear, constant vigil. And then I was in the toils again. For about the time Ebbe landed in New York and was parked because he was penniless in Calvary Mission, I'm sitting at the kitchen table. Lois is working in that department store. I had a communication, a kind of a language of the heart, with the delicatessen up there, which supplied me with gin on credit. And I sat drinking and the telephone rang. And now I knew that this was it. Something told me so, and science had driven in the last spike. I was nailed down to stake. So the telephone rang, and here's Ebbe. I thought he had gone to the booby hen. I said, "Come on over. We'll talk about the good old days." I would have buried his neck a lot. The good old days. Today was unbearable, and there would be no future. So we would talk. He appeared in the doorway. At once I sensed something indefinably different about him. He came in. He sat at this kitchen table in the basement. On it I had a big pitcher full of gin with a little pineapple juice splashed in so it could suggest cocktails instead of the straight stuff when Lois got home from the store. So I set out the tumbler for him and started to pour. He said, "No thanks." "What?" "No thanks." "Well, what's got into you, Abby? Not drinking?" "Well," he says, "I'm not drinking today." "Well, oh," I said, "oh, let's have it." Well, he looked at me and he said, "I've got religion." Well, if I'd been deflated by the scientists, this really let me down to the middle of the earth. Because I had had a wonderful scientific education, too. Just like our last week, I knew that. Well, one must be polite, so I said to call it a brand. And then, being very careful to avoid the aggressive evangelism of the Oxford group, he merely told me his story, how he'd met Hazard, come to New York, and he felt unaccountably released from this desire. This release was a new one. I was always talking about the water wagon. So, his story carried great conviction to me. Over this identification, no doubt at great depth, over which simple ideas could be picked in, instead of having to use the corkscrew of the psychiatrist in the top, he was able to go right straight through. He hadn't presented me with a single new idea at all. But I will say that after that conversation, I could never be the same man again. And so, without pressuring me at all, he took his leave. Said, "I'll see you later." In no waking out in the days that followed, there could be vision of Abby. Vision crossed that table, leave me. And, of course, I felt trapped. I said, "But if I only could go along with it. Honestly, yes, you could make a try. Helping other people, dandy. You know, I'm public spirited. Et cetera. But the God's there." And this had really, although he had played it down, appeared to be the crux of it. So finally, one morning after Lois had gone and I'd got partly tanked up, I said, "I've got to get a clear look at this thing." So I arrived up at Towns Hospital, half sued. Dr. Silkworth looked at me sadly, and I brandished the bottle and yelled, "Doc, this time I got something." And the old man said, "I'm afraid you have. You better get upstairs and go to bed." I wasn't in too bad shape. Sedative and that sort of thing was out of me. 2 or 3 days. I was a month or two early. And then, suddenly one morning about 11 o'clock, Abby stood in the door. Well, I was glad to see him, but I suspected that this was the time he turned up the heat on the evangelist. Well, now it is said by theologians that prudence is one of the greatest virtues, and Abby had it, and he knew my past mind. So he quietly sat down and we began to talk about folks at home and this, that, and the other thing until he obliged me to ask him, "What's this little bunch of cliches now? Let's see how it was. You admit you can't run your own life. Are you get honest with yourself about it? You talk it out with somebody, part of a confession. You make restitution for harm. And then you pray to whatever God there is." "Yeah," Abby says, "that's about it. Now, what do you think it's going to rain tomorrow?" He kept messing with that. And finally, without exerting 1 ounce of pressure on me, got up and went out of there. And I thought to myself, "Well, gee, this fellow really practices what he preaches." He had already bound me to him in the cords of a new understanding and love, spoken to me in depth in the language of the heart. We all know what happened. Thus, I was prepared for the great event of my life. So, after he has gone, of course, I commenced my old struggle with the God bit. And I finally thought, well, was it the egg that came first to the hen? And I could not decide. And this let me down into a depression, and I've had some dandy sense, for which there was no description at all. I mean, the sheer hysterical agony of it is beyond words. And finally, and momentarily, for indeed I know, last vestige of this prideful obstinacy rubbed out. So, as a small child, frightened by the dark. In this strange womb in which I had found myself, I cried out, if there is a God, will he come? Instantly, the place seemed to light up in a blinding flare. I was instantly transported into an ecstasy beyond description. I began to have visions of the mind's eye, thought. It seemed to me that I was on a mountain. A great wind was blowing, and it came around me, and then it passed through me. And I thought to myself, this is not of air. This is of spirit. This is the God of truth. And then the ecstasy subsided a great deal. I found myself lying on that bed. But now I am in a new dimension. Just as our late friend put it, I was a part of the universe at last. In however small a way I did belong. And I reveled in this. And then at length, science came back and said, my God, you're hallucinating. Well, then comes the little doctor who loves drunk. I had summoned him. I said, Doc, as well as I can recount it, here it is. This is what has seemed to happen, what I know has happened, and yet I am frightened. Am I hallucinating? He questioned me very carefully and very gently. And he finally said great words for Alcoholics Anonymous. Said that obscure little doctor with no professional reputation, Bill, some great psychic event has occurred. And don't pretend to understand it. I have read about these things in the book. I know they happen. Now I have witnessed one. And, dear boy, whatever it is, you better hang on to it. It's so much better than that which had you only an hour ago. Well, those coming hours were grateful. This reassurance that I was not lunatic helped. Suppose he had spoken to me other words. I'll give you a sedative. You'll feel better tomorrow. Perhaps this would not have altered the course of events. You know, it was the humanity of the man. So, the very next day, Abby brought up to me a book from which we drew another part of this sentence. And that book was written by William James, called by some father of modern psychology. And I read through this book titled Religious Experiences. That one was memory left. Here are the variety of religious experiences. Okay. Here they were. The manifestations were many. Sometimes they were electric, sudden, overwhelming. At other times, they moved very slowly. They came under the auspices of religion, but also to an agnostic looking out a window, saying, the tree can respond to the laws of its nature, and I cannot. Oh, higher power, oh God of the universe. And then, suddenly, or slowly, transformation is set in. Now, as I read through these many descriptions, certain common denominators darted out. Nearly all of these transforming bases, experiences laid on a basis of calamity. Concerning a controlling situation in the life of the individual that on his resources or on any other resources could not be transcended. He could not get over, he could not get around, he could not get under. And when that got him at death, he was wide open for what we agree with our friends of religion is God's grace. So, the problem of bringing other alcoholics to this experience was not the problem of bolstering up this issue. It was of deflating it. Well, as a deflationary tool, one thought, well, Jung had handed it to Hazard. Ebby had handed it to me, but most particularly had Silkwood. In other words, here was my God of science saying, for you, I can do nothing. So deflation at depth, today we bring on by talking about a compulsion that condemns us to drink, coupled with a physical condition that condemns us to lunacy and death. And when that is projected over, transference so easily get with each other in this kinship, then there's the deflation. Then when people turn to AA, even in dependence upon AA as God, of course, this transformation sets in, the one we know so well. Well, you know the rest of the story. I fussed around the ark with drunk. The experience had a certain paranoid component. I was prone to grandiosity. I think I announced during the first 6 months I was going to fix all the drunks in the world, which is a long departure from experience. Ego came back. So I and the damn one got sick. Until I arrived in Akron, and here was dear Dr. Bob. And so I said, I'm going to quit preaching. I'm going to quit demanding that these people have an experience like mine. Indeed, this was another cornerstone. If I am to stay sober myself, for I had been disconcerted by the failure of a business deal, I need this other alcoholic drunk or sober worse than he could ever be. Well, we struck that mutuality. I got off of my pedestal. It clicked. Soon after, there was a third. And in Akron, Bob was just 3 minutes. Again, in this benign sense, medicine, religion, and our own experience launched a set of transformations running through 5,000 drunks at Akron in Bob's lifetime, and with Ignatia and co-workers in the area to another 10,000 up to this time of his death. Such is our debt to medicine. Such is our debt to Christian teaching. Such, my friend, is our debt the everlasting sun.